first time with Feist.
Helping the kids out of their coats, the way the babies haven't been born. Unpacking the bags and setting up, and planted lilacs and buttercups. But in the meantime, I got it hard. Second floor living without a yard. It may be years until the day my dreams will match up with my pay.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and I'm back with a new season of The First Time here on BBC Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians, authors, actors and artists around, and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today. This episode's guest is an acclaimed Canadian singer-songwriter who's now six albums into a brilliant career, one that's stylistically taken in folk, indie, jazz and alt-country, and lyrically tackled everything from hugely personal emotive heartbreak to pure joyful pop. And she's sung with the Muppets. I'm very pleased to say my guest for the first time is Feist. And in this week's show, we talk about Feist's earliest musical influences, the impact her creative, arts-based parents had on her, and the start of her career and background in the Canadian alt-rock scene. We also discuss her first solo album, 1999's Monarch, her breakthrough track, Mushaboom, which you just heard, and the colossal success of her massive single, 1, 2, 3, 4, and how you deal with the fallout and expectations that follow in the wake of that attention and recognition. And yes, we do talk about performing the track on Sesame Street with the Muppets, a video of which has been watched over 953 million times on YouTube. We also cover her most recent album, Multitudes, and some of the musicians that mean the most to her, including Dusty Springfield, Sarah McLachlan, and Blake Mills. But I started off by asking Feist, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time she was aware of music?
Wow, that's such a good question.
Thank you.
I feel like it's not any significant song or something, but my grandma was a fantastic alto, like a deep, beautiful alto. And we had to go to church, and the best part was standing next to her during the hymns. And I remembered feeling kind of starstruck that she had this beautiful voice. And so she was just sort of not singing around the house so much as hearing her at church. And then there was an organ, a little combo organ that she also, for some mysterious reason, knew how to play. But it wasn't like it was all the time. But when you say what was my first memory, it would be my grandma.
So even there you've got, if you're going to church to hear music, already music's important. It feels like something that's got a certain ceremony around it. It means something.
I love that thought of the beautiful version of church, but I weirdly went to, in the prairies in Canada in the 80s, they had this like rock and roll church idea where there was just someone playing a bass and someone playing an acoustic guitar. And like, it was more fun to go to rock mass than the normal mass, but it was, let's just say it wasn't like glorious and beautiful or anything.
What about the first single that you owned?
First single, like the first time I went to buy a record was Sarah McLachlan.
Okay.
It was a record, it wasn't a single, but I had seen a song on Much Music, which is like the video channel, the MTV of Canada.
Okay.
And I saw a video for Drawn to the Rhythm and then went and tried to remember her name as I walked to the store and bought my first record.
What was the store like?
It was called HMV. It was like a big, you know,
we
big
have
store.
HMVs, or we had HMVs.
Exactly, we had it. It was just downtown. And it took me years to discover the indie record shops. But at that point, it was sort of, where do you get records? At HMB. So that's where I went.
What were your first obsessions musically? Who did you really, who did you want to be? Who were the posters on the walls?
Well, it was all pretty low-hanging fruit in the sense that it was the most popular stuff, because the joke in my family is that I think we had a record player and I remember a stack of records, but why did we only listen to Dr. Hook and Hooked on Classics? Do you remember Hooked on Classics?
Oh, my dad had a cassette of Hooked on Classics that we used to listen to on family holidays in the car endlessly. It was like a medley of classical big hits.
Yeah, with sort of disco behind
it. With a disco beat behind it. They were. I think it's awful.
Yeah, so not the most, you know, not the deepest. My dad, because I grew up with my mom, but my dad had great records. He had Kraftwerk and Art of Noise and Roxy Music and Pat Metheny and Frampton and Jimi Hendrix and, you know, lots of cool music going on at my dad's house. But where I was living primarily was sort of Dr. Hook and Hooked on Classics territory. So there is definitely an imbalance there in terms of the background music in the house.
Yeah, yeah. First gig you went to?
Janet Jackson.
Oh, nice.
I think it was Rhythm Nation Tour.
Of course.
Yeah, like, that was a big deal.
Tell me about getting the ticket and going to that show.
I think it must have been a friend of my mom's or something that took me, because I don't remember who I went with, but I was young enough that, oh no, I'm wrong. That was the first one I went to on my own with my friend.
Right.
It was Tina Turner, Private Dancer. You're private dancer, dancer for money, do what you want me to do.
Oh, this is like massive 80s.
Yes, I was probably
hits.
9 or something, and we went to the arena.
The Enormo Dome.
And the Enormo Dome, exactly. And I remember not being able to conceive of the fact that she, because I'd never seen a concert. I'd seen some plays like Peter and the Wolf and the, you know, children's theater kind of stuff. So maybe I wasn't used to that scale, but I remember the thought going through my tiny little head of like, she must see me. Like, I couldn't conceive that I was one of thousands and thousands. I was like, you know, a little kid, like feeling like I was making this connection with Tina Turner.
Can you remember anything else from the show? Can you remember how it made you feel?
I remember I was allowed to wear my mom's ring to that show, and then I dropped it in the bleachers.
Ooh.
Like I was fiddling with it or something, and it came off in the bleachers. So, you know, there were no cell phones with lights on them at that point. I think I spent half the show just pretending I was playing down below in hopes to find it so that my mom wouldn't know that I had lost it. And I did find it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you're on the edge of your seat there.
And then Janet Jackson is a little bit older, just with your buddies.
Yeah, I must have been maybe 13 or something like that. And I don't remember much except the excitement of, you know, probably the smell that I didn't know how to identify that was weed, you know, but it was just groups of people. And I was probably people watching as much as I was watching the stage. It was just so fun and felt so grown up.
Was there any idea of like, oh, that thing that's going on there, I feel like I would like to be part of that?
Certainly not, I would say. Yeah, Janet Jackson probably was more suited to that venue than I was. she it was incredible. It was like big production, dancers, the whole, you know, it was, I remember being pretty excited about that.
So if that's the kind of mainstream, when did the alternative indie punk world kind of, when did that door open for you?
Well, I guess there was a really strong indie scene in my town, Calgary. And my friends were, you know, different friends were the ones who would rent the Students' Union Hall to put on a show, or rent the community center down on the different part of town and put on shows. And they were all ages shows. So I was going to these shows, and we started to go to them. And then eventually I was going to so many of those shows and was in choir at school. And these girls walked up to me in the hallway when I was maybe 15 or something and said, hey, we see you at all the shows. And I was like, yeah, oh, you guys go to those shows too, you know. Because I was at a pretty straight-laced school, and it was sort of, would have been noteworthy that anyone from that school was going to the gigs. And they were like, well, you're in the choir and you go to the shows, and we need a singer for our band. So
that's like a John Hughes movie moment, isn't it? That's so cool.
Yeah, I had
you?
A
me?
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't quite the Freddie Mercury outside the venue singing to the guys loading their van up type moment. But, you know, I had a four track. I was, you know, had been making kind of like sound sculptures, you know, couldn't really call them songs, but definitely been recording. But I wouldn't have gotten into the, you know, the rigor of songwriting until they asked me to join.
When did you first hear Dusty Springfield?
Well, Dusty Springfield has been in the background my whole life, listening to her in the radio or in the back of a taxi or in a restaurant or something. But it's really only really recently that I happened upon her in a more, you know, in my car, something. It was loud, and it was a song that I had never heard, so maybe my ears opened to it because it wasn't just Look of Love or Son of a Preacher Man or something where you're just like, yeah, yeah, I know that song, like it's part of who I am because it's just been there always. But it was a song called Just a Little Lovin' Early in the Morning, and it's just such a perfect composition lyrically and the arrangement. And I got so certain that who's Dusty Springfield and why was she so close with Burt Bacharach? They must have been, because I was so certain it was a Burt Bacharach song. And then I found out it wasn't. It was a songwriter team whose names I don't remember right now. Basically, I heard it and the puzzle of it made me think, I want to find a biography. I want to learn more about her. I want to understand, because I heard her voice for the first time. I heard the incredible, like, how can you have that much tone and warmth and texture and like pillow talking, and then, but she can just sort of pierce out in this beautiful clarity like a bell. It's rare that you hear a voice as characterful as it is, you know, capable of doing whatever, like acrobatically perfect as well, you know.
Just a little love early in the morning, beats a cup of coffee for starting off the day. Just a little loving when the world is yawning makes you wake up feeling good things are coming your way. This whole world wouldn't be half as bad, it wouldn't be half as sad
or something to kind of see them through. Nothing turns the day on, really gets it done, like a little bit of loving from some loving someone like you.
Celebrating the legacy of hip-hop across the summer here on 6 Music.
And on BBC Sounds right now.
We're taking it back to the golden era, the 1990s.
Cash rules everything around me, cringe at the money.
When I see
why. In the 90s, just feel in the 80s, right.
This is how we chill from 93.
The Huey Show.
You'll be hearing from rappers and MCs.
Jam Supernova.
I'm going to the School of Hip-Hop.
And Giles Peterson.
I'll be celebrating the DJs and producers.
Hip-hop forever on 6 Music.
You can feel the realness.
Listen now
on BBC Sounds.
Let's do another first.
Mm-hmm.
Your first guitar. What was your first guitar?
My first guitar I bought from a roommate when I was maybe 17 or 18.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in a band in that town called Wagbeard. And
that's a terrible name.
Terrible name, but you know how band names, you don't even hear them anymore?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You just, they're just like, who thinks about Foo Fighters? Like, what is that even, what is it? But everyone just says Foo Fighters. Well, Wagbeard was like that. It was just a name. And they were sort of the lords of our town. Like, they were the best of the bands, you know? But anyway, I bought a gold top Les Paul.
Ooh,
special.
Wow. That's a pretty big jump.
Which was silly, from nothing to that, because I had been playing an acoustic, maybe, I can't even think of where that would have come from. It just would have been around in the corner of the room and maybe lent to me by someone. And so then I thought, I'm going to buy one. And then that was the one I bought. And then my uncle, who was in a really beloved rock band in Canada called Junk House, he was also a guitar collector and had a recording studio, all this stuff, but way across the country in Toronto. And so I was just, when I bought this guitar, moving to Toronto, and he's like, look, you've got this Les Paul, you're not going to cart that thing all the way over here. Why don't you let me sell it for you? And with that money, I'm going to buy you another guitar and you're going to have a whole bunch of cash to start your life in Toronto. Because he was right. He found me a $200 that was way cooler, called a JK Lado. They're Canadian made. They're a single piece of wood. I called it smoker's tooth because it looked like it was sort of this crackled yellow, yellowing white, used to be white kind of thing. And it was a perfect electric guitar. And he did exactly as he said. He sold the Les Paul for some pretty penny. And then I got this great guitar and a chunk of change. So pretty memorable, actually.
First time in a recording studio.
It would have been that same uncle, Dan Aiken. You know, my first, that band, the girls who walked up to me, we were called Placebo, which is sort of, like whoops. Many years later, then the band called Placebo came along. So we recorded in what I thought was a studio, which was a cool guy's basement, you know, with gear and mics and stuff. But then once I moved to Toronto, my uncle had a studio in an industrial town outside Toronto called Hamilton, and invited me out there, and I, you know, kind of much more wide-eyed, like a real studio. Those days, it was more like exciting to see how the process even works. Mm-hmm. Like, do something and listen back. And I think also when I was that much younger, I didn't have much sense of good or bad, even. I had a big forgiving pillow range of what was okay. Like, I've heard live board tapes of early shows and stuff, and now I'd be like, whoa. I wouldn't be pleased, but when I was young, anything went. You know, it's just all fun. It was just fun and exciting. So it wasn't until years later that I was in a proper recording studio and I started to make Let It Die. That was like probably the first time that I was in a studio yeah. for any length of time.
So tell me about that first proper album then. What memories have you got from doing it? Was it a good experience?
I think the songs that I'd written before Let It Die, I had four-tracked. I was still using a cassette four-track. There was something where I didn't really understand what it was, but I could make a kind of a gain, like a crunch. Like I could make the volume limit itself and get sort of compressed and crunchy sounding. It was like an imperfect, but I liked it. It was sort of what, when you listen to Guided by Voices, you're listening to a lot of like this sort of like a tape sound. And there was something in that I could hide a little bit and obscure. And it's like an effect, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not pristine like this microphone is, you know? And when I went into the proper studio in Paris, Studio Ferber, I was working with Chili Gonzalez and Renaud Latan, and they wanted to be a production team, and they were just wanted to see what it was like to work with each other, and I was truly their test subject. We weren't recording me for me. It was like, I used to tour with Gonzo, with Chili Gonzalez, and it was on a day off on tour, let's just go in, and they wanted to see what it was like to work together, and I was the subject. So it was sort of one of those, you know, walking into the ISO room, the beautifully silent, you could drop a pin and not even hear that. You can't, you know, you hear nothing. It's like carpeted and pristine. And there was a preamp glowing with the tubes inside and like a beautiful, huge microphone suspended in all these elastic bands. And it was as far from my cassette four track as possible. And I thought, whatever happens, it's going to be the truth, a truth that I hadn't encountered yet. You know, whatever I hear, it's going to be more real than what I've ever heard before. And I remember feeling a little bit like kind of bungee jumper style, like I'm, well, here I go, and we're going to see what happens. And that might have been the first in terms of first recording studio moment where I was like, okay, well, let's see what I'm capable of or something, you know?
Let's do another artist. A's.
A's are Amelia Meath and Alexandra Sauser-Monig, who were two-thirds of Mountain Man, a really fantastic American, you know, perfect harmony singing trio. And they wrote some of their songs, but did a lot of amazing vocal arrangements, like Andrew Sisters style, like vocal arrangements of traditional songs. And Mountain Man were my backup singers for 2 or 3 years during the record I made called Metals. Since then, Amelia has become Sylvan Esso, an American, amazing American band.
Yes, yes, yes.
And her and Alex, two-thirds of Mountain Man, have formed another vocal duo called A's, like A's, A, Alex and Amelia. And it's just delightful beyond any, you can't imagine. The arrangements are just, it's so stripped of production, and there's like sometimes a guitar, sometimes just like a little tiny clinking percussion. But so it's like perfect harmonies, basically. It's just what two voices can do. And two voices with like tons of warmth and humor and irreverence to a pop moment, they're doing the exact opposite. And it's incredible and adorable.
Oh, in a day, it'll be a while. But when I die, I'll need to remind you that I'm sorry I left you behind. And I'm kissing you through this one. Oh, when I die, build a funeral pyre. 'Cause when I die, I'll need to remind you. Better build it high, make it burn so bright. let it light you way back home. Oh, when I die, march me to the fire. 'Cause when I die, I'll need to remind you. Play the music loud, sing and dance around. Oh, ring all the bells in our town. Oh, when I die, raise your glasses high. 'Cause when I die, I'll need to remind you. Drink to my life, and forget me not. In your mind, I'll be living on. Oh, when I die, eyes open wide. Oh, when I die, cover me in flowers. So you look my way as you walk on by. I will be perfume in the air. Oh, when I die, it'll be a while. But when I die, I'll need to remind you that I'm sorry I left you behind. And I'm kissing you through this song.
I'd like to talk about 1, 2, 3, 4. I was watching the video, not the Sesame Street video, the dance video, with my daughter, who's 4, and she'd never heard the song before. And she was just completely bewitched by the music and the colours and the dancing. And then we watched the Sesame Street one, which is just utter joy. It is pure, unalloyed joy. And like, what is, I mean, 945 million views or something like that. And I just thought, what a beautiful thing to have done. Like, the two sides of a coin both being joy. It is, though. It is. It's true. It's a lovely, the risk of sounding very pretentious now, it's kind of a lovely gift to give to everybody to do something like that, aside from all the other machinations around it. How do you feel about that song?
Well, I like your take on it. Because I think after all these years, what's left is just, it is sort of a moment. Mm. And the moment was coming from a place of, it was kind of like, in spite of all of the chagrin or sarcasm or, you know, whatever I could have expressed at the time, there was something that felt cheeky, or like, it just felt kind of, given where I'd come from, sort of hardcore music, 1, 2, 3, 4 felt like a bit radical in its ultra simplicity, its sort of unapologetic, melodic hand clapping. You know, it was just something that to me felt so outside of what I was used to playing. And it is a little filament of joy. There's not many in my life where I've made a video that makes me like the song even more than I did when I recorded it. And then the Sesame Street, they made that, the kind of the choreography with the puppets and stuff to echo the video, as you might have noticed since you watched them back to back.
Yeah. But like, I've interviewed Kermit and Miss Piggy in this studio, and I try and tell people the kind of impact that it has on you being in their company, and it's them.
Yes.
It's an astonishingly emotionally powerful and pure emotion meeting a Muppet, isn't it? It really is. I'm enthusiastic, but it was incredible for me.
I absolutely understand, because Sesame Street was incredible because it was like walking through the TV into the past. So I'm walking onto the set, and it was sort of like how I'm in a dream or something.
Feist and the Sesame Street version of 1, 2, 3, 4, which has now had like over 952 million views on YouTube. And we'll talk about the phenomenon that is 1, 2, 3, 4 and her new album, Multitudes, right after the Six Music News.
Six Music.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
BBC News at 9:30. I'm Mike Powell. England's cricketers have dramatically won the final Ashes test against Australia to level the series 2-2. After a rain delay this afternoon at the Oval in South London, a batting collapse saw the tourists bowled out. Our sports correspondent Joe Wilson was watching.
The last two wickets were taken by Stuart Broad in the final minutes of his illustrious career in the way he's done so many times for England over the years. So there it was, in the evening sunshine, that Australia's quest to chase down 384 finally ended. This match was won by England. This series will finish level at 2-2, and it is Australia who retain the Ashes.
All four teaching unions involved in a dispute with the government have accepted a pay rise of 6.5%. The largest, the NEU, said the award would increase the average teacher's salary by £2,500. Ministers said it was good news for teachers, parents and pupils. A retired British miner has been released from custody in Cyprus after judges gave him a 2-year prison sentence for the manslaughter of his seriously ill wife. David Hunter was freed after the hearing because he had already spent 19 months in jail. The 76-year-old was asked how he felt as he stood outside court.
I can't describe it. I'm sorry. I wish I could. I wish I could find words to describe it. I can't.
Thank you.
When you're under pressure for 2 years, wondering which way it's going to go, you don't know what to think.
Climate campaigners have condemned Rishi Sunak's announcement that more than 100 new licences will be granted for oil and gas extraction in the North Sea. The Prime Minister insisted the move was entirely consistent with the UK's net zero commitments. While visiting Aberdeenshire, which will also benefit from millions of pounds in government funding for one of two new carbon capture projects, Mr Sunak said it made sense for Britain to produce the energy.
What is important then is that we get that oil and gas in the best possible way, and that means getting it from here at home. Better for our energy security, not reliant on foreign dictators. Better for jobs, for example, 100,000 supported here in Scotland. But also better for the climate, because if we're going to need it, far better to have it here at home rather than shipping it here from halfway around the world.
The Islamic State group says it carried out yesterday's suicide bombing at a political rally in Pakistan, which killed at least 54 people. Police say almost half the victims were children. The Court of Appeal has ruled that members of the public do have the right to wild camp in Dartmoor National Park. The decision overturns a High Court judgment handed down in January. And the United Nations Cultural Agency, UNESCO, says Venice should be added to its list of endangered World Heritage Sites. It's accused the Italian authorities of neglecting to save the city from damage. And that is 6 Music News for tonight. Good night.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
Welcome back to The First Time here on Six Music and BBC Sounds. My name is Matt Everett, and we just played My Moon, My Man by our guest in this episode, Feist. And a few moments ago, we also played a bit of the Sesame Street version of Leslie Feist's life-changing worldwide hit, 1-2-3-4. So how do you cope with that moment in your life as an artist? How can anything prepare you for the first experience of massive success like she got in the wake of that track being released?
It's something I could say I sustained myself through. It wasn't really like I thrived or I...
And I had a great time every day.
And I didn't collapse, you know. It was, but there was a sort of a G-force to it. There was a... it was sort of like every day needed more hours all of a sudden for right. The amount of velocity moving through all of these various things I had to do all of a sudden. But I had come from... You know, loading my gear into a van and driving across Canada, which, by the way, there are not many cities there. So the drives are long. And I had done a lot for so many years that before I was on a label, before I had anyone helping, putting records out and touring them around North America and then Europe a little bit, sort of just one gig to the next. Like, who did you know that could get you? That arguably is harder, you know. There's something about the DIY... roll your sleeves up and everyone has to do what you got to do to kind of get to the next gig kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And luckily I had been forged by that long right. before this sort of stuff happened. So first of all, there was a little bit of a, I guess I had played enough and lived enough that I could see this moment for sort of what it was.
Yeah.
And I wasn't, I don't know, I kind of kept my head, I suppose. And yeah, I don't know. I just met it as best I could. And then at some point, I looked at the calendar like this endless yellow brick road or something, and I just had to draw a hard line and say, I'm
with
done.
With potholes in it.
Yeah, maybe some potholes. Like, it was time to go home at some point after. Because yeah. I had been on tour at that point for something like 6 or 7 years straight. So it was sort of like, okay, I think I met it as best I needed to, and now it's time to take care of myself, you know.
But it buys you freedom. It doesn't necessarily make you happy, but freedom makes people happy. Freedom's a good thing.
That's absolutely true. I mean, I feel like 1-2-3-4, for all of its, you know, double-edged swordness or whatnot, I do have a freedom now to make records when I feel it's time and to tour as much as I want to. And so it's a gift that keeps on giving, I should say.
Where did you first hear Molly Drake?
I don't know how I happened upon Molly Drake, but the story came with her. The music came with someone telling me this is Nick Drake's mom and she didn't ever make music that anyone heard, which is so remarkable because the songwriting is just so beautiful and distilled. And the story was that, you know, she had a reel-to-reel tape machine sitting on top of a piano and just wrote and sang for her friends or family and recorded them in this way, like her husband had given her a gift of this recording device or something. And you can picture little Nick Drake like laying on the carpet coloring or whatever, listening to his mom, who happens to be this world-class songwriter, and you hear her voice do that thing that 30 years of singing can do, you know, a very high, sweet 20s all the way through and probably into her 50s or 60s. Hearing time pass through someone like that, it just really struck me that she would be so dedicatedly working on her craft, to be doing it truly just for her own, you know, just for her own interests and her genuine love of what she did. And that it's only modern times that make us think we're supposed to always be pointing outwards. But I found it so beautiful that she pointed that, you know, straight towards the people in her immediate circle. And it's only by chance that we get to hear them now. I just found that so beautiful.
Yeah, it is. What song should we play?
I really like Love Isn't a Right. It's a very good sentiment.
Then we'll play that one.
Love isn't a right, it's got to be earned. Love isn't a right, that's got to be learned. Maybe you spent your natural life loving husband or loving wife. Were you loving and was your love returned? Love's nobody's fool and nobody's slave. Love won't go to school and learn to behave. Ride your love on an easy rein. If love can go, it comes back again. Love will haunt us from cradle to the grave. Love's a whisper, love's a shout.
love's a flame that could blow out. Love's all beauty, but make it a duty, and love will lie right down and die. Love is a germ you never resist. Love loves the eternal will-o'-the-wisp. Follow him through the darkest day. Love will glimmer and light your way. But grab at him and he flickers away out of sight. Love's enchanted, don't take it for granted. For love isn't a right.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
6 Music's Artist Collection, where we anthologize an artist. This time, we're celebrating one of the biggest rock bands of the 90s. Oasis. Showcasing their best live performances. Iconic interviews.
Geeker walked up to me and he said, what are your band called? And I said, Oasis. He said, do you want a record deal? So he said, yeah, why not?
Plus, curated playlists and highlights from the BBC archives. 6 Music's Artist Collection, Oasis. Listen now on BBC Sounds. 6 Music.
I want to talk about Metals, because for me, that's my favourite record.
Great.
Even from the first song, like The Bad in Each Other, the texture of it, the sound of it, it's kind of... It announced itself. It announced a very different world in a really, really positive way. I'm just paying you compliments now.
But thank you. I'll take it. As long as they remain on the air.
And that record, making that one, that was big sale, wasn't it?
Yes.
That's a nice place to work.
Yeah. I had taken a couple of years off after that 7-year stint. Mm-hmm. And there was something about I wanted to record a live record, you know, have something that wasn't really constructed. The reminder was, a lot of it was live, or at least chunks of it, you know, we'll do the rhythm section or do the, and then, you know, add bits or whatever. But I thought, no, what if we just actually get the people who I know would be the right people into a room and rehearse before we get there and then just play it, you know?
Yeah, because you can hear fingers on strings and pedals slightly creaking. It's got that,
yeah,
that world to it. That's articulating it much better than I was able to do.
Well, Robbie Lakritz, he produced this record with me, that Multitudes with me, but that was the last one that he produced as well with me, with a bunch of us, Chili Gonzalez and Maki and Robbie. He built a studio for us. We found a barn in Big Sur, like a big, huge barn, where the downstairs was where the family lived and the upstairs was the mother of the family's sculpture studio. But it was massive. I mean, he said it was the footprint of Abbey Road Studio A. Of course, he would know that, because as an engineer, you're really nerdy about that kind of
geeky about that stuff, yeah.
Kind of dimensions of a studio. But yeah, he put microphones over the rafters and down in the staircase and behind the couch and underneath things. And so there was sort of just this array around us. And then we would play live, and then he would pull up on the faders of like how the different triangulations of those different... Like, where was the feeling? Was it the one down in the stairs mixed with the one right next to me? Or was it the, you know, and it was really nice to just leave the world, because there was no internet connection at this barn. There was just sort of eating, sleeping, hiking along the cliffs and working. Keep me lifted up like wings.
imagine who's listening, and it's not all of you. See the red wing, and the red wing sees me too. The endless weight of our lives can be lifted up like wings. The underneath of our lives, effortlessness in it sings.
Let's talk about this new record. Let's talk about Multitudes. Let's talk about the obvious question. Why is it called that?
Well, that's a good question. I don't have an answer for that, really. But I guess it felt in the last few years that I had the single self, the person I had been white-knuckling and really committed to being, you know, because I thought, in a way, like, becoming an adult is like a fixed point. Like, you know, when you're a kid, you grow up and then you're just like an adult now, as if you are just one thing. And I was maybe just reaching a point where I was understanding the versions of me that were necessary for, in any given day, there's the you with your child or with your grandmother, or if you are a grandmother, who you are with your former students or your uncle or your, you know, just these dynamics you have with people and the various yous that show up to that. But then that's the axis of today, how many yous there are. Now you go back to when you were 8, or you go forward to when you're 98. There was just this, I don't know, the crucible of becoming a parent myself and losing a parent. There was a new sense of the, I suppose, the Multitudes was born from the idea of that I wasn't going to be able to withstand the new amount of responsibility on my shoulders if I was not allowing myself to evolve and change and remember the assets of being a little kid and hold respect for the woman who I will age into, the 89-year-old in me that is I hold in trust. She's waiting for me to lighten up a bit and like get a little more, you know, lighter touch. Just, you know, the sparkly-eyed, wise crone that I hope to become, maybe, if I'm lucky, you know. And all of those selves, I've been facing them more in, they've all arrived into the now somehow, because I've just been reformulating how the hell you're supposed to live, how you're supposed to continue with adulthood shifting like it has been.
I've got a version of me that's like in a cream linen suit in his 80s, living just on the edge of a village somewhere, and it was like, that's a strange guy again. And I come into town, buy some vegetables, flirt with the people in the counter, moan at other people and sort of stagger back again. He was a weird guy. I can't wait to meet him.
Right.
I mean, it's probably not going to be like that, but I'm quite excited about him.
What do they say? You can't have anything you can't imagine having. So you can see him.
Yeah.
You could be him.
Yeah. Do you have any concerns or worries about talking about, you know, your father's death and talking about motherhood around this record? Because the minute you put it out there, it becomes, everyone loves a story. People like to put a story on an album. And those are your things. You don't have to tell anyone about those things.
Yeah.
At all.
Absolutely.
I mean, it frames the record, but that doesn't mean that anyone deserves to know about your personal life. But you made that decision, which is kind of brave, but I wondered why.
Well, I guess it's not personal in that I think humanity's here because motherhood has always been a thing. It's just new to me, you know.
It's
sort of, I've
people
been marveling.
Doing this for a long time.
Yeah, and I'm kind of blown away that not only everybody ever, but my mom, my good friends who became moms before I did, there's a universal thing there. What my subjective experience of it is not on the record. You know what I mean? It's my daughter's in there because, of course, she's become such a big muse for me. And my father, I mean... I don't know. I suppose in a way I've checked in with him. I've had that conversation in my mind about, is this gotten strange?
Okay.
And in some ways it has. And I think it's inappropriate to continue to, because he's a little bit more, it's a bit more specific. I can speak about the people who have lost a parent. They know. And there are certain things you'll never be able to explain unless a person walks a mile in your shoes, sort of thing. So there's the universal feeling of that shift when you've lost someone. And I'm trying my best to respect the line that in me knows is too far. Because the way songs function is that if I can put my experience in them so that when I'm the sparkly-eyed 70-something-year-old and singing them, I will remember exactly what I planted, almost like leaving little breadcrumbs in the forest. I'll remember a state of mind that a phrase came from. I'll remember where I was walking when I found that like Let It Die, I remember where I was walking when I wrote the chorus, like which block. And to this day, I walk past that particular intersection in Toronto, and it's December again. There's snow on the ground. It's sort of like a time capsule of a certain phrase and memory, a triangulation of time. And this record and the experience of becoming a mom and losing my dad, they're in there for me to find when I'm in my 70s, you know?
The saddest part of a broken heart isn't the ending so much as the start. It was hard to tell just how I felt to not recognize myself. I started to fade away, away.
So as long as I keep the journal entry out of there and I don't feel the need to share the crux that I particularly am experiencing, then I don't think I'm doing anyone a disservice. And if anything, it's just sort of the container inside of which these songs were born. It's alchemy. You take one thing and it becomes something else. And I certainly had those two experiences make me into something else.
What was the song that unlocked the record? Like you're starting a session or you're putting some songs together and there's one kind of comes together or makes itself known a bit early and you're like, you're the sign. You're the pointer. Now
you're right. There usually
now
is.
Now we know. Yeah. We know where we're all going now. What was the one on this record that did that?
I'd say it was two, because the two first that arrived was Red Wing and Enlightening. And they had nothing to do with one another. Somehow they didn't sound like they came from the same record. But they made me bookend somehow. They gave me a kind of a from A to Z sort of sense of the kind of like sonics, and the subject matter in both of those spoke to a kind of unearthing. Like I found myself appreciating that they are as specific as can possibly be for me in my Twinkle Eye 76 rendering. The scaffolding of a perfect song for me is one where I can find myself inside of it as if it's my own words, you know, in terms of listening to something.
Okay.
I find myself inside of it. I'm completely feeling it because it's words I've said in my head that I haven't found a way to say yet. You know, maybe Love Isn't a Right, the Molly Drake could be an example of that. So there's craft in that. You know, you feel like you're inside a bit of magic when Ron Sexsmith writes a song that all of a sudden I'm like, of course, exactly. That's sort of like a friend says something and you bang the table like, yes, that's exactly what I think. But I just hadn't said it that way, you know? And so that's sort of the approach I was finding in that Lightning and Red Wing kind of led me into lyrically deeper into that idea.
And the last song, Song for Sad Friends, and I've talked about this with other people, I'm really obsessed by final songs on records. Oh. Because I think the final song is never a single, it's never a song that you could put second or third in the sequencing. Often when people write them, they're like, well, yeah, that's going to be the last one. We know that's going to be the last one. It almost has to occupy that space. That's also why I love records. If you go back and you think about lots of the albums that you love, think about the final song. The final song is often the soul of the record, at the risk of sounding pretentious. It's got something to it that tells you a lot about everything else that happened on that album.
Like the epilogue.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that thought. And when you frame the Song for Sad Friends in that light, I'm thinking, well, yeah, I suppose it's because the change that has happened in me from some of the hardest stuff I've ever gone through, I'm grateful to it, you know? And so why would I take the chance of that evolution from my friend is sort of the idea. And that's kind of the journey of this Crucible album sort of thing. It's, you know, I get self-conscious, like it's innately selfish. Like, why are we talking about me and my minute feelings or something? But I guess it's just what songs are there for. They're to meet these like little subtle, usually quite isolating little crossroads that we can find ourselves in. And that's kind of the only company you can have there is songs. But so many songs have kept me company in those moments. I remember discovering M. Ward post-war, Lucinda Williams' Fruits of My Labor. I mean, some of those songs where there's like a timbre and a warmth or the texture of it that even just without the words is a comfort. And then the words come there. It's like this double companionship or something. And I guess there is that idea of pay it forward gratitude I've had, thinking if I can make some little containers like that, then that's a great way to spend my time.
And the final thing, what's the last song that we should play?
During the pandemic, while I was writing, I discovered this Blake Mills song, Summer All Over. It was one of those ones that, like, I couldn't find my footing, or I couldn't find my bearings in that early lockdown, because my little one was 4 months old, 5 months old, around the same age as yours, when the pandemic struck. And I've discovered this Blake Mills song, Summer All Over. And I remember having headphones on, and I listened to it like 77 times one day. I ended up collaborating with him kind of based upon this memory of his power of being able to deliver me through a really difficult time.
Then that's the song we'll finish on. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Look, it's not gonna rain again. Winter is over. It's summer all over the world. June, the color burned away. Now the old gloom hardly knows her. It's summer all over.
Blake Mills and Summer All Over, the final choice of my guest on the first time today, Feist. Her album Multitudes is out now, and she's playing Camden's Roundhouse in London on the 9th of September and the Victoria Warehouse in Manchester on September the 11th. Tomorrow on the first time, I'm joined by actor and musician Damien Lewis. We'll talk about terrible band names, the differences between centering yourself as a musician and an actor, and his experience of a gig that I wasn't allowed to go to, Queen at Wembley in 1986. If you can't wait till then to hear another first time, go to BBC Sounds, where you can catch up with the archive, including shows from Janelle Monáe, Dave Grohl, Mark Ronson, and the late Sinead O'Connor. Next up is Riley & Co. Until tomorrow, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.